So hey guys, we're back with another one, and today we got a fantastic guest on the phone. We have a gentleman who's written a book called Salt and Snow, Lansford W. Hastings, The Donner Party, and The Haste to Blame by Eugene R. Hart. And we have Eugene on the phone today, and we'll be talking to him about his life, and he's got a crazy life. When I was reading his bio, it's like, what doesn't this guy do? And then we're going to be talking about his book, and the reason that he decided to write it and the research. But before we do that, I want to thank my friends over at True West Magazine at truewestmagazine.com. I urge you to subscribe. If you go to truewestmagazine.com and up in the upper right-hand corner, it'll say subscribe. You hit the subscribe button. It'll bring a drop-down menu of all the different ways you can get the magazine and the history delivered right to your door. I have it. I love getting the pictures, the color photos, and the maps and the details, and Ask the Marshal, and then Bob Bozbell's artwork. Like, it's all there. It is, in my opinion, the number one magazine for getting the history of the Wild West brought right to your door. I'm not paid to say any of this. This is just because Bob is a good person and has helped me over the years, and I appreciate everything he does for me. Also want to thank my friends and second family at the Wild West History Association. You can find them at wildwesthistory.org. If you're like me and you want deep research with true provenance, you don't like stories, made up stories and, you know, fantasy stuff about Western history, but the actual truth, then join the WWHA at wildwesthistory.org and become a member. It's about $75 a year, and you get the journal 4 times a year, and it's a great way to get true research, true provenance. There's no ads in the magazine. It's actually like a mini book, and it comes right to your door, and they got cool stuff, and I've told everybody, and I'm not lying. Like, I'm just a guy doing podcasts, and if it wasn't for the WWHA, I would have never met people like Peter Brand and John Bosnecker and Bob Bozbell and Linda Womack and Mark Lee Gardner and Mark Warren. Mark Warren's coming up on a future podcast. Like, all of that is because of my second family at the Wild West History Association, and that is at wildwesthistory.org. Also, real quick shout out to my friends, especially Eric Wright, who said, Mike, you got to interview this guy. Got to contact him. He's got a cool story. And that's my friends over at the Tombstone Epitaph, Arizona's longest running newspaper. Get delivered right to your door. It's a great newspaper. I just got it yesterday when I came back on business. And there was Eugene's face. I was like, holy crap, there's Eugene's face right on the back. So thank you to Eric and Mark Boardman for all you've done for me over the years. And I appreciate you a bunch. And if you want to subscribe, go to TombstoneEpitaph.com. So Eugene came to me through, like I told you, through the Epitaph and through Eric Wright, and I didn't really know anything about Eugene until we started talking, and I got his phone number, and we actually started emailing first, and then we found out, okay, we need to talk more because there's just too much to the story. And he wrote a book about the Donner Party, and there is a ton of books about the Donner Party. Like, if you go to Google or Safari or any search engine and go Donner Party, it's going to bring up jokes, pictures, history, fiction. I mean, just tons of stuff. But somewhere in Eugene's life, he decided to research a little bit more and found out that this gentleman, Lansford W. Hastings, may actually be, is the one being blamed for the Donner Party, but that may not be true. And so we're going to talk a little bit today. So welcome, Eugene. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Thanks for having me, Mike.
Thank you. You've got a pretty freaking cool life. You grew up in Indiana. You graduated with a degree, and then you moved to Breckenridge, Colorado. Was an avid skier. You went to Yosemite Valley for the first time and was stunned, you wrote, stunned to see people climbing gigantic rock faces. You moved to Merced to be closer to Yosemite, but then you got into peaking. So tell us about that. First off, welcome. Like you said, thank you for being here, and I appreciate you being here. How did you get into peaking?
Well, Yosemite's kind of the mecca of the world for climbing. And I'll never forget the first time I saw people climbing it. I just could not believe it. And it's just, I'm one of those guys, when I see something that looks interesting, I want to do it myself. And I just got into rock climbing and hooked up with a lot of good rock climbers. And I climbed pretty much every wall in the valley itself. And then beyond that, I got involved in ice climbing. And I ended up going down to Peru and bagging some pretty good sized peaks, anywhere from 18,000 to 22,000 feet, and had a great time for about a 7 year period. Then I realized, well, you know, you've had a lot of fun. You got the ski bug out of your life. You've climbed and ice climbed everything that you wanted to do, and it's time to get serious. So I went back and got my teaching credential. And got hired, and for the next 37 years, I was an eighth grade U.S. history teacher.
But that's the short abbreviated part, right? Because I read that you moved to Fresno because you still wanted to keep climbing because you wanted to be close to Yosemite, correct?
Yes.
So are you still climbing today, or are you like, well, man, it's time to hang it up?
No, I gave it up. I can't stay in shape the way you have to be in shape. And that's how you get into trouble, thinking you're in shape and you're not. So I kind of gave it up. I'm into bicycling heavily now, though. I ride my bike, 100 to 150 miles a week. And I don't know. It's just something I enjoy and, pay attention to traffic and hopefully have a nice career there, too, staying in shape.
So you're in shape and not into donuts and tacos like I am.
I eat those too, but it's just in moderation.
Okay. Well, good to know. So, because I do come to Fresno quite a bit, so I'll make sure I give you a call when I come to Fresno next time.
Sure.
You got into teaching, but as you got into teaching, you noticed, it says here, that every year I taught Western history and the Donner Party. So you were doing Western history. How did the Donner Party get into your teaching?
Well, they were part of my westward expansion unit, and and they were a perfect example of how the American dream can turn into an American nightmare if you're not careful, because the Sierra had just recently been opened to wagon travel with the Stevens Townsend Murphy wagon train, and so the Donner Party was going to actually be part of the second group of immigrants that were going to cross the Sierra into California in the year 1846-47. So they were just part of this history. And then as I read more about the Donner Party, Lansford Hastings' name kept coming up in a negative light, you know, as if he was this oily tongued salesman that lied to people and was caused the death of people in the Donner Party. And I thought, wow, this guy's a pretty terrible guy. And I thought, well, maybe I should research him a little bit more, because and all the books that I've read about the Donner Party and westward expansion, he always comes up as this really negative guy. And spoiler alert, through my research, I found that he really wasn't the cause of their disaster at all. In fact, he tried to help them more often than not, even though he was kind of a spectral, person in the story, because there were only three people that had a direct connection with Hastings face to face. Everybody else, everything else was through his guidebook or through the three people that went ahead to find Hastings to tell them that there was a better route south of the Great Salt Lake.
So let's talk about Lansford Hastings a little bit. He's born, correct me if I'm wrong, because all my guests, they do at some point, and I don't care. I love when they do. He was born in 1819 in Mount Vernon, Ohio. It says that he died in 1870 in St. Thomas, Virgin Islands at 51 years old. He was a trained attorney, correct?
Yes.
And then eventually he wrote a book called The Immigrant's Guide to Oregon and California.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about a little bit about that book, because that Immigrant's Guide is really what was pushed in the East Coast and Central America And people were buying up that book to read it to move west.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a lot of things going on in 1845 and 46. For example, as I mentioned earlier, the Stephen Townsend Murphy Party had finally opened up a route that, through the Sierra Nevada, that they could get wagons across. John C. Fremont's third expedition in 1845 took a new route south and west of the Great Salt Lake for a more direct connection for immigrants to get into California. And of course, in 1845, Lansford Hastings wrote his and published his book, The Emigrant's Guide to Oregon and California. And the book was a promotional guide of the West, and it was full of hyperbole and occasionally misinformation, but it had a lot of good information too that historians and writers just seem to ignore. And they kind of cherry pick and make him in the light that makes him look the worst. But really, Hastings' guidebook was excellent when and in regard to how to prepare, what to expect, and when to travel. And he had incredibly good advice. He said, for example, you know, if you're going to travel to the Pacific, you need to get the best wagons you could possibly afford, because you don't want to get out of 100 or 200 miles out on the trail and realize you could have improved some things that are going to be really hard to fix en route. Examples of hyperbole, he said that there were at least four passes across the Sierra and all of them were easy. That's absolutely not true. And when the Stephens Townsend Murphy Party went through, they did get through the pass, but it was not easy by any stretch of the imagination. He also exaggerated, saying that in California, that oats and wheat, the stalks of oats and wheat were so strong and so tall that you could use them for walking canes. So, but the thing is, the bottom line is that didn't hurt anyone. You know, it's so what? It was hyperbole. So what? Things weren't quite right. He had a lot of good advice, and he would say things like, you should use oxen because they can take a lot more. They could take a lot more endurance than horses or mules. He also said, don't overload your wagons with excessive kitchenware. And, he recommended that each person have at least 150 pounds of bacon and 200 pounds of flour so that you could, you know, have enough food from the beginning to the end of your journey. So it was just loaded with good information that the Donner families, George and Jacob Donner family and then James Reed family took to heart, but a lot of it they didn't take to heart too, because, pretty much all their wagons were overloaded to some degree. And we know this because of artifacts left behind at the two winter encampments that they stayed at during the winter of 1846-47, one at the lake and one at Alder Creek. So it was full of really good information, but a lot of historians and a lot of authors seem to not pay attention to that.
So what's going on with your phone? Because you're getting muffled on me.
Oh. Are you there? I should be fine now. I don't know what's happening.
Oh, is it not moving around?
No.
You're not falling asleep?
Let me just set it up here. How about, okay. Is that good?
Oh, my God. Much better.
Okay.
So he's written a book. This book is going out. And people, I would assume, are like, oh my God, we're going west. People that were not trained to the elements, and they're moving west because of this book, correct?
Yes. Crazy. Yeah, because Mexico was trying to populate its upper provinces, and the best way to do that was to give away huge tracts of land. And a person going through the right channels could acquire 48,000 acres, which is about 75 square miles of territory, which was, you know, a fiefdom of land. And you couldn't get that anywhere else. Even in Texas, the land grants that Mexico was giving away were about 4,600 acres per person, generally. And later on in Oregon Territory, you could only get 160 acres to settle on. So Mexican California, I mean, there was this opportunity to own a bunch of land on a scale that was just impossible to contemplate anywhere else.
So they got all this going on. They're starting to move west. they're starting to find routes and trails, and the Hastings cutoff is one of the areas that we discussed. Talk about the Hastings cutoff.
Okay. When John C. Fremont actually blazed the first trail south of the Great Salt Lake and west, and then at the Ruby Mountains, he split his men, and some of them went to the north of the Rubies where you could get through with pack animals because it was a narrow pass. But by wagon, you would have to circumnavigate the Ruby Mountains. So John C. Fremont split his men up into two groups, and they knew that there were two ways to get around the Ruby Mountains and reconnect with the traditional California trail and then into California. So when Fremont arrived at Sutter's Fort, he eventually met Lansford Hastings, and Hastings was really excited because he realized that Fremont's opening of this new route was going to make it a lot easier for Americans to move into California quickly. And make no mistake about it, Hastings wanted to overthrow the Mexican government in California because he believed that their government was corrupt and Americans had a lot to offer, and he was going to lead people into California and either have them, you know, join the Americans or lose it through conquest. So Hastings, in his excitement, decided to retrace Fremont's route in reverse with the intention of opening up a new wagon route to California. So he was able to successfully do that, and he worked his way all the way to Fort Bridger. And at Fort Bridger, he went a little bit beyond and sent forth an open letter saying that there's a new route that will knock off anywhere, roughly at this point, he was thinking himself probably around 300 miles that would make the trip to California 300 miles closer. And he would personally lead them if they would go to Fort Bridger where they could take his new route, where he would personally guide them. So by July 20th, there were about 300 immigrants and 70 wagons, and the Donner Party was straggling behind. So they were already lagging behind. But so Hastings decided to go ahead and start the new route with wagons and working their way down the Wasatch Mountains. His partner, James Hudspeth, decided to take a route through the Wasatch that had not been explored by Hastings and himself earlier that year. And Hastings was in the back trying to get, you know, slower wagons to move forward. And by the time he realized that Hudspeth, his partner Hudspeth, had taken wagons down a new route, it was too late. So the route that Hudspeth chose turned out to not be the best way to go. So Hastings rode all the way back to the junction and left a note saying that do not follow this route. It's way too difficult. Send someone forward and I will show you a better way. So when the Donner Party found that note, they sent James Reed and two others to track down Hastings, which they did 2 days later at the south end of the Great Salt Lake. And then Lansford Hastings, the next day, or actually later that day into the next day, backtracked into the Wasatch Mountains, and he showed Reed the route that he should take to descend the Wasatch Mountains, which was the route that Hudspeth and Hastings had taken earlier that spring. And what's interesting is that Reed was able to retrace the route that Hastings pointed out to him all the way back to the Donner Party. And he could see just how difficult it was going to be. But when he got back there, he said, yeah, it's going to take some work, but we can do it. And that turned out to be a huge mistake because there was one section of the Wasatch Mountains that took them 16 days to hack through 35 miles of trail. So the Donner Party at this point was essentially cutting out their own trail until they got into the Great Basin proper and then was able to follow in the ruts of Hastings through the rest of the route.
So all of this is going on in Utah. If you guys are wondering, this is all happening in Utah, correct? The Wasatch,
yes.
The Great Salt Lake, the Great Basin is going on in Utah. If you're wondering who we're talking to, this gentleman, his name is Eugene Hart. He's written a book called Salt and Snow, Lansford W. Hastings, The Donner Party, and the Haste to Blame. You can get his books through contacting him direct at public publicimagelimited13@gmail.com. I'm going to say it real slow. publicimagelimited13@gmail.com. He sells them all by himself. He doesn't have it in bookstores, but it's pretty cool. It looks like a textbook. The picture or the cover is a high gloss cover, and the book is filled with footnotes, just tons and tons of footnotes that back up the research that he did. So if you're a reader, historian, or somebody who likes history with footnotes to prove that there's provenance to what he is saying, this is the book for you. Again, you can get Eugene's book at publicimagelimited13@gmail.com. There were about four, I read somewhere, there were about four trails, different trails in the area. The Brian Russell party came through the Weber Canyon, correct? There were different trails. Through the Salt Lake Valley. The Brian Russell party came through Weber Canyon. The Harlan Young wagon party came through Weber Canyon to where US 89 is today. The Leinhard party came through Weber Canyon to Keys Creek, and then the Donna Reed party came through Immigration Canyon. And like you said, they literally, even though it was a trail, I don't think it was really a trail. I think they were bushwhacking.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%.
So,
and then, go ahead.
I was going to say, so the Donner Party came through a trail through Immigration Canyon, and then they took this cutoff that Hudspeth recommended, correct?
They took the cutoff that Hastings and Hudspeth had explored earlier.
That's right. But that's
the route that they should have taken to begin with, but Hudspeth guided the group that he was leading through the Weber Canyon instead of Immigration Canyon that they should have gone down.
See, I told you I was going to get something wrong.
Hudspeth should have taken the route down through there. So he was trying to find a better way into the Great Basin, but he was doing it at the expense of the immigrants. So he was not the best guy to be leading at that time.
So now the Donner Party is days behind, if not weeks behind, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And
they're over 2 weeks late at this point.
And they're marching now, not marching, but they're going across the Great Salt Basin. And I read about a spring or something that was used for water. And they went across the Salt Lake. The Salt Lake is not easy. I mean, you go across the basin from Salt Lake City and you think, oh, there it is. But today, if you go around modern day Tooele and go down around the, when you're going towards Reno and you go around Tooele, it continues like that Salt Lake continues for hundreds of miles. And it couldn't have been easy pulling a wagon and a wagon train, correct?
Oh, yeah. And then there was another little surprise that was not mentioned by Fremont or anyone else at the time, and that's the water table on the stretch from the Cedar Mountains to the next available source of water, which was Pilot Springs. Mm-hmm. That 67-mile stretch through there had wet spots in it. It was like an oatmeal-like consistency where the water level was just below the surface, and it made pulling their wagons incredibly difficult, and they had to work their way around that too. And but no one knew that until they were well into it. And plus, all the Donner wagons, most of them were overloaded. Their animals were starting to get jaded, and now they have to pull through this oatmeal-like crusty salt that was going to slow them down even more.
And they were pulling across, like you said, like this oatmeal consistency, and the animals, there's no water. And the animals are getting, and a lot of them died.
Yeah. The last place they could water was discovered by Hudspeth on his way back after leading the mule train of the Bryant Russell group. So on his way back, he found a good spring called, they named Hope Wells. And that was the last place that you could water up before you crossed the Cedar Mountains and then the Great Salt Desert to Pilot Springs. And while they were there, when the Donner Party caught up to that camp at Hope Wells, there was a second note left there that was shredded by birds, and it's kind of cryptic. So it makes me wonder if there was more to that the letter left behind than was discovered. But it said, 2 days, two nights, hard driving, cross desert, reach water, which was shocking news to the Donner Party because they had heard there was a 40-mile section with no water. But the way they interpreted that information, that skeletal information, 2 days and two nights would mean four shifts of 12 hours each. Hmm. Hard driving meant covering 20 or more miles per day. So you got 20, 40, 60, 80, and they're thinking, my gosh, this route is not 40 miles across, it's 80. It's double what we thought. So they had to figure out the algebraic equation of how they were going to deal with this. And of course, they loaded up as much water as they could possibly get into their wagons. And that would last them approximately for the first 40 miles of travel across the Great Salt Lake. But then you have another 40 miles that was waterless. And so I think the thinking of the time was, if you carried water, you had water until it ran out. And then there was a stretch of desert where there was absolutely no water and you had to press across that. And that was that turned out to be a disaster for the Donner Party. Then keeping in mind, a few animals were lost by the group that Hastings and Hudspeth were leading, but they lost no property and no wagons at all. But by the time the Donner Party got there, they were in such bad shape that they ended up losing. Well, James Reed almost lost all three of his wagons and his animals ran off. He lost 18 of his 20 animals on the Great Salt Desert. George Donner lost one of his wagons, and a Prussian or German immigrant named Louis Kiesberg lost one of his wagons as well. Reed was able to borrow enough animals to go back to his wagons and bring one of them in. And which wagon did he bring? He brought in this large family wagon that he had built way back in before they left Springfield, Illinois. And the reason he had this larger wagon built was for the comfort of his mother-in-law, Sarah Keyes. So at that point, I don't know, it wasn't in Reed's best interest to take the family wagon, this large oversized wagon, and bring it into to camp, but that's exactly what he did. And they held on to that wagon until they got along the Humboldt River, and then they finally had to give it up. It was just too big and bulky and impractical. And it actually was impractical from the start.
What a story. Because I've driven that route between Salt Lake City and the Nevada state line. And even when you get to the Nevada state line, the salt flats kind of end, but then you've got a mountain range to deal with. And we take it for granted, being in our air-conditioned cars, listening to Sirius Satellite, drinking a soda, we're just kicking it on cruise control. And if you look out there, like, those salt flats are virtually unchanged. That's exactly what the Donner Party and all the parties pretty much looked at as they came west into California and Oregon. God, that's crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's intimidating. Even today, you're right. It's intimidating to look across that and just think that, you know, we're in our air-conditioned cars and, you know, just enjoying the story and the amount of Herculean effort it took to cross that desert by wagon. And but even today, if I lived during the 19th century and I was looking across at that desert, I'd be scared to death.
Well, I probably would have stayed in Salt Lake City because I know the Wasatch Front and it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Tons of water. It's green. There's, you know, hunting, you know, like, why would I leave that? Just, you know, to go to California when, you know, Utah has got everything I need. Crazy. So
yeah.
You're researching your book because Hastings is really the one that's getting the blame. Correct?
Right.
I mean,
yes.
He's getting the blame for the Donner Party. And the Donner Party, as we all know, you know, an early winter snow came and buried him, you know, cannibalism and the whole thing. Just crazy to think that that went on. But we know what happened. But Hastings is being blamed for it. Why do you think it is that Hastings was so easily blamed for the Donner mishap?
I think because some of the hyperbole and misinformation in his guidebook, some people felt that they couldn't trust him. But if you go back to the very beginning in Springfield, Illinois, he had a lot of good information that you know should have been applied. In fact, he suggested to anyone leaving that you should leave Independence, Missouri, no later than May 1st. The Donner Party left on May 12th. So right off the bat, they lost 2 weeks of time that they would have been better spent traveling instead of, you know, preparing for, you know, the at a later date in May rather than May 1st. So there were a lot of children, too, in the Donner Party. There were, I think, 45 people that survived out of the 81. And out of those 45, 32 of them were children. And I think a lot of people just, you know, you don't want to kick a man when he's down. But in Hastings' case, he was the convenient scapegoat because the Donner Party had suffered so much that there had to be someone responsible for it. And Hastings got the blame. And I think it's unfair because he helped the Donner Party so much more than he possibly harmed them. And he had a lot of good advice. And by the time the Donner Party had reached the base of the Sierra, in the guidebook that they possessed, it said, do not attempt crossing the Sierra Nevada after October 1st. And it was late October, and they decided to take a chance crossing the Sierra. And that gamble turned into a nightmare for them because, of course, you know, they got trapped in snowstorms and help was not forthcoming for about 3.5 months.
So I'm trying to, in my head, trying to determine, like, should we go on to the next part, which is, you know, who is to blame? Because part of me wants to talk about who is to blame. Do you think we can do it without giving away too much of the book?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so who then do you think? Because I read a lot about Hudspeth, that possibly Hudspeth was to blame. But you, do you think differently? Do you think that Hudspeth had something to do with it? Or do you think Reed had something to do with it?
To be honest with you, I think everybody had a little bit. There's enough blame to go around and not necessarily focus on one person. Yeah, you could say, yeah, Hudspeth was guilty because he took wagons down a route that had never been explored at all, and he did that without the knowledge of Hastings. Hastings gets some of the blame because he didn't I don't think he realized that getting wagons across his route was going to be way more difficult than by pack train. So I don't think he fully understood that until it was too late. But then again, he was also able to get the immigrants and their wagons across his new route without a single loss of life. And people forget that. James Reed, he's part of the problem too, because if you want to, you know, call it a problem, because he was he was overly optimistic, and he just, got a little bit careless as a result. And even the proprietors of Fort Bridger, Louis Vasquez and Jim Bridger, they're part of the blame too for painting Hastings Cutoff as this relatively easy route south of the Great Salt Lake. And they promoted Hastings Cutoff because they wanted the wagons to go by their fort so they could make a ton of money. So there's plenty of blame to go around. And, you know the old saying, if you point at somebody, you got three pointing back at you. So everybody's a little bit guilty here, so to speak. But, you know, that was the, I think it was a sign of the times. People were less timid and willing to accept the consequences of their actions. And, you know, because the Donner Party never really criticized Hastings until much later. So, and James Reed and Lansford Hastings actually had a cattle contract. They were going to sell cattle to the U.S. Army in California. And so if Hastings was this hated man, it sure wasn't with Reed, and Reed's family suffered greatly as a result of Hastings' new cutoff. So I don't think people were really in the mood to blame. They were just caught up in the optimism of the century.
But I think there's still somewhere. I get the three fingers pointing back. I get that. I do. I think there's still somewhere, though, the ultimate blame. Like you mentioned, and I read this in an article. I prepared a lot for this podcast, if you didn't know. I read in an article that after the Donner Party, the survivors were interviewed, and many of them blamed Hastings.
Yeah, well, that stems from J. Clint Thornton, who allegedly interviewed the Donner Party survivors. And they didn't really speak out against Hastings too much until they had an interview with J. Clint Thornton, which his book, which is called California in 1848, I think it is. It's full of a lot of information that's just simply not true. Mm-hmm. But J. Clint Thornton, I think he wanted to be very sympathetic to the Donner Party, because when Thornton was going to California, actually going to Oregon at the Humboldt Sink, he veered off on a new route called the Applegate Cutoff, led by Jesse Applegate. And Applegate led them on a new leg of the journey through Black Rock Desert that cost them their property and almost their lives. So J. Quinn Thornton was a very sympathetic ear for the Donner Party, because he had been through what he definitely believed was misinformation and led almost to, to down the path to death. And he associated Hastings as that same kind of character, when in fact that Hastings was doing, what any good guide would do. He's trying to get people to California as fast as possible and make it a reality so that America could influence the destiny of Northern California.
But that's what's so crazy is I read some of the interviews of the survivors of Donner Party. And like you said, they ended up blaming Hastings, but nobody took blame for themselves almost. Like nobody said, we were 10 days behind. We messed up too.
Right, right. And I don't know. I think people just wanted to forget about it, the survivors wanted to forget about it at some point. But I would be careful with J. Quinn Thornton's assessment, because he might have written down what he wanted them to say as opposed to what actually happened. And then the evidence I look at with Hastings and Reed, working together with a business deal of that cattle contract, it just seems you would think that Reed would hate Hastings, but he didn't at all. And I think people just accepted the responsibility of their decisions. And then much later, it's easier to point the finger then after you've thought about it for quite a while, as opposed to what really happened in real time.
Well, if you're wondering who this extremely smart man is that we're talking to, really fantastic interview. I'm blown away at the information that you've researched. You can find this book called Salt and Snow, Lansford W. Hastings, The Donner Party and the Haste to Blame by Eugene R. Hart. He does not sell through Amazon or through the big booksellers. If you find him at a book event or a signing event somewhere in Northern California, he'll sell a book to you and autograph it. You can get a hold of him as far as his book signings at Public Image Limited 13. So that's Public Image Limited 13 at gmail.com. Public Image Limited, the number 13 at gmail.com. And he'll let you know where he's going to be in Northern California for a book signing, and he's selling books. And like I said, it's a textbook style book. It's big in nature. It's got a really great cover on it. Packed full of footnotes. So if you like footnotes in your reading to really drive home the fact that he's researched everything and everything he found is factual, then this is the book for you. Especially if you want to learn about the Donner Party. That's the big thing, to learn about the truth about the Donner Party and not what's been written out there about, you know, from other people that, you know, may not have gone, you know, deep into the archives to find this information. It's a fantastic book. What were we going to say before I cut you off?
Oh, I was going to say, my book is available on Amazon.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so fantastic.
I don't know if you know, also on the book, but there's a really nice fold-out map in the back of the book itself.
There is, I saw that.
It's well done, yeah. In fact, I designed it so that you could open up the map and read the book and follow along with the map as well as you.
I didn't know that. I'm glad you said something, because I was looking at the map going, the hell is this? He's got a big map, but then what? And it's numbered. I'm like, what do these numbers mean? But, you know, that's good to know. I didn't know it was on Amazon, because our European, Australian listeners, you know, that's important, because shipping is so expensive. Even if you want, though, to have that personal signed autograph, you can go to publicimagelimited13@gmail.com. Otherwise, go on Amazon, because it does save on international shipping, and you can get the book delivered right to your door. Is there a, that's kind of weird. I mean, we got about 20 minutes, 15 minutes. Is there a takeaway on this, like on the Donner Party, you know, with miscalculating time, an early snowfall? I read about the cannibalism part and it almost made me sick in some of the stories that I read about what happened. Is there a takeaway? Like, should we blame the Donners? Were they at fault, even though they endured so much? Or is there really one single, even though we said there's multiple people to blame, is there really one single person or entity that really should have, that history should have looked at instead of Hastings?
Well, I think if you accept the authority of a guidebook, then you can't pick and choose what works best for you or what's most convenient for you. If you like, for example, when you go back to the very beginning, you know that the Donners clearly overloaded their wagons, and we know this because his daughter later said that one wagon was full of farm implements and seeds and merchandise that was not to be touched until we got to California. So I think that they brought all these, carried all these goods to California, ignoring the advice of Hastings when, you know, they should have been, if they had followed his advice and left Independence, Missouri on May 1st rather than May 12th, I think if you're going to follow a guidebook, you need to follow the guidebook, not just pick and choose what's most convenient for you. And the optimism of Hastings and especially James Reed was very contagious, and people just accepted, you know, didn't really question James Reed's authority that he had over the wagon train, even though he was kind of disliked by others, but admired by still more that thought he was a natural leader.
So I got one more question. And it's gonna, my listeners are like, "Ooh, here it comes." It's gonna be about the time machine. Have you heard this question before?
No.
Okay, it's about a time machine. My regular listeners, Tom Betts, is like, "Ooh, what's he gonna say?" If you could get in a time machine and go back to the Donner Party, to that expedition, knowing that you can't change history by giving your advice, but to see something, to see an event during that period, to see it with your own eyes, what point in the Donner Party would you like to go back to just to visualize? But you remember, you can't say anything to the Donner Party because you can't change history. So, but what point would you like to visually see?
I think when the Breen family left Truckee Meadows and made their ascent of the Sierra, made it all the way to Donner Lake, which is called Truckee Lake at the time, and then at the western end of that lake, it just turned into this wall of granite. And then, of course, the snows began about that time, too. I would just like to sit there and just watch the heartbreaking desperation that the Breen family and a few others were encountering as they tried to push over the summit of the Sierra, but with no avail. And then they ended up having to go back down to the eastern end of the lake. And when they went, when they returned, other people were arriving from Truckee Meadows. And then the Breen family told them of the difficulty that lay ahead and all the snow. There was snow 2 feet deep in some places, and it was just nearly impossible to cross. And I think that would be something to see, just maybe the shock and reality that things were going to be incredibly difficult from that point on. I'm sure they never thought of cannibalism at that point, but as time went on, that became a reality that they would have to face in order to survive.
Fair enough. It's a difficult question because I've answered it before. Like, I've asked a question before and people have had some really, you know, I'd like to go back to the OK Corral and see the gunfight, or Dr. Gary Roberts wants to go back to see a specific event in Doc Holliday's childhood just to see it, see if it really happened the way it says it did. So, are you working on anything new?
No. I'm pretty satisfied right now with working out of my trunk and of my car and hitting up historical history centers and things like that. So, I don't know. There may be another book in the future here, but I can't imagine it right now.
Well, that kind of sucks. I was kind of waiting for you to say, yeah, I got something new, but now, now I can't call you a lazy bum because you're not doing that. You're all over the place selling the book.
Yeah. That keeps me busy.
Okay. Well, we're talking to, Eugene Hart. He's written a book called Salt and Snow, Lands for W. Hastings, The Donner Party and the Haste to Blame by Eugene R. Hart. Like you said, you can find it on Amazon. I didn't know that, but you can find it on Amazon. And if you want a more personalized book, you can go on publicimagelimited13@gmail.com and you can get it there. And Eugene will send you out a book and he'll autograph it. And he did say that he does kiss each book before he wraps it and sends it and says, you know, gives it like a go be with your next family talk. But he's doing a great book, and we've actually spoken quite a bit, and this is going to be my next book to read because I really want to dig into it. I want to thank my friends at Wild West History Association at wildwesthistory.org. That's a great organization to join. $75 a year, you get the journal, and you get to meet the best and biggest historians in Western history today, like John Bosnecker and Linda Womack and all these amazing people that I've met over the years. Also want to thank True West Magazine, truewestmagazine.com. Want to subscribe, hit the subscribe button. There'll be a menu and you're good to go there. Tombstone Epitaph, Arizona's longest running newspaper. It is an actual newspaper. If you're like me, I like to take it with me on the plane and read it. You can be a subscriber at tombstoneepitaph.com. And again, we're talking to Eugene R. Hart. He's written a book called Salt and Snow. If you look on your picture there on your podcast, you'll see the cover, what it looks like. And his Lands for W. Hastings, The Donner Party, and The Haste to Blame by Eugene R. Hart. It's available on Amazon and through his email at publicimagelimited13@gmail.com. Of course, if you're listening to me wherever you're listening to me on podcasts, please give a rating and review. That helps a bunch. If you're over on iTunes or Spotify, hit that subscribe button. But yeah, ratings and review help me out a bunch. And I appreciate everybody who does listening or does listen. We've got a lot of podcasts coming up in the month of June and July, so you don't want to go anywhere. Also, if you're going to Roundup 2023 in San Antonio, Texas, I will be there, and I am going to be geeking out totally on my friend Peter Brand. I've never met Peter. We've been speaking for years on the phone. We have a podcast coming up about the unearthed information regarding Josephine Earp, Sadie Marcus. I can't even wait to do that podcast. But I'm going to be geeking out over Peter Brand because he's going to be there. And so, Peter, I'm sorry if I look at you with loving eyes. It's because we have finally met, and he's just a great person. And we spend too much time on the phone between Arizona and Australia. And he's always got something going on. And he's got new content, new books in the work, and I can't wait to meet him. So, and I get to hopefully I get to see you at Roundup as well. So, again, appreciate everybody. Thank you so much. Leave a rating or review. Hit the subscribe button. And remember, safe travels, and we'll see you soon.